good early morning, ladies and gentlemen out there. It's extremely early my time. As I record this, it's approximately 2:47 in the morning. And you're wondering why I'm recording at 2:47 in the morning, and I have to tell you, a weird thing about me. When I wake up, regardless of what time I might wake up, but when I wake up, that's usually when brilliance shines through for no logical reason I can deduce. But it seems to always be the case that immediately after I wake up, there's all these great ideas and all these things I didn't think about. And my temptation is to go on about the day, do whatever it is I got to do. And I realize I'm losing a lot of great ideas. I'm thinking about games and songs and podcasts and books and all sorts of creativity that gets lost because I simply act, because I recognize life and I continue forward. I'm no longer doing that. I've refused to do that. So as of about, maybe 10 years ago, I decided that I was going to act on these. Every time I wake up and there's something, I'm going to note it down. I'm going to do something. Whether I actually take it to its fruition is a different conversation, but I at least note it down, if nothing else, because I don't want to lose what might be a great idea. That's the reason for the idea that spawned the book that preceded the pandemic, but the book was actually about the pandemic. So that idea that I never finished the book, primarily because I was focused on the work, which was a mistake, came because I woke up in the morning and realized, you know, there's an idea here, and I've written 4 books, published one of them, and I've got this thing here, and now I can take and just document the idea, even if it never turns into anything from me. Because here's the truth. Many of these ideas, if not all of them, are going to live on beyond me. So if I can make them available and somebody else can take advantage of them and do something with it, all the better to it. If I get credit for it, that'd be even better. Because there's been a lot of situations like that. Tolkien is a great example where he had a lot of stories that he had written, and they never came to fruition until long after he had passed. And of course, he got credit in retro, but then when you look at some of the works that he had done, some of them are rough, right? They're very difficult to follow, especially if you're not an active reader of books. I'm not talking about Kindle. I'm talking about the physical book in your hand, because it's harder to, I believe, retain a lot of information when you're reading it off screen compared to when you're reading it from a physical book. This applies mostly when it's like a fiction book or a science fiction book, not necessarily textbooks. I think textbooks, it goes either way. But when you have these ideas and you just put them to paper and then file them away, and then later they turn to be a thing, that appealed to me. So what happened was I woke up in extremely early, and I get some ideas. And in this case, it seemed to best fit for the gentleman's world, because it doesn't fit cryptocurrency and it doesn't fit boxing. It certainly doesn't fit boxing. And I thought I would talk about it on the episode as kind of an omnibus, but basically what's going to happen with this idea, it took 3 approaches. One, I'm going to evolve gentleman's world as to more an omnibus episode. What I mean by this is it's going to cover a lot in a certain span of time that I haven't determined yet. I need to figure that out. I'm probably thinking about an hour and a half-ish as a full omnibus episode, where I'm then going to parcel out segments of the show for different platforms. I think this might make the best sense overall in order to make sure that I get the content out as much as I can to different platforms, because I don't want to leave it isolated in its own podcast form where it never gets an opportunity to be heard by a larger audience. This doesn't mean that I'm actively marketing Gentleman's World. I never have. It's kind of just been there, nowhere near what crypto's doing. Crypto is actively marketed, actively put out, actively social media. I might put 1 episode of Gentleman's World on social media every blue moon, but I've never promoted it in the way that I'm thinking of, because now that I have this idea and I realize that, yes, I could do this and I can kind of bridge platforms, because right now the only podcast that I have that's on YouTube, as an example, is the boxing one, predominantly because that's where the people are. It does not It used to, but it does not any longer exist on the core podcast platform, nor does it exist anywhere on Spotify or Apple or any other platform. Whereas crypto is all over the place because I actively do it. And then Gentleman's World is on a couple of the key ones, but it's not on every single one. But I needed to make sure that I give some attention, though, to Gentleman's World, because I do think that some of these ideas should be heard somewhere. And it's important that regardless of whether something comes of them, somebody gets some value out of some of this information, because I don't want the information to be lost forever. Que sera, que sera. So what that means is that there's going to be a segmented approach to the show that I got to figure out on the omnibus episode when you hear it, number one. Number two, each of those segments I'm going to make available as kind of a snippet of the episode, which means I have to get creative with my recording because I don't even do this on the crypto side. And so I got to build more of a format structure that makes sense for the segmentation that I haven't thought through yet. I'm pretty sure I can make it work because my software automatically supports it, but it's figuring out what makes sense in terms of the segments and the time slots and still making sure I meet the hour and a half that I'm targeting and go no further than that as possible. Then it's making sure that I already have the place for the YouTube side ready to go. But that's different because it's video and there won't be active video, but there will be screens and other content to kind of support the audio that I got to figure that out. That requires different software. That's a little bit of a pain to record. And then I got to think about storage overall because my storage multiplies times 10. There's a lot to think about, but I'm sharing this because it means that the podcast that you hear today, the content will be largely the same, but it's going to have a more segmented approach so that I can piece out portions and parts of the podcast for different purposes. So the structure will sound a bit different. The content is the same, and I want to make sure that that's clear and people understand how that's going to work going forward. But it should not significantly change the flow of the podcast for those that subscribed. And by the way, I do appreciate you for having done so. So first up in today's episode, and this will be one of the partition ones because this content I think is valuable outside of Gentleman's World, I want to tell another story. And this story is going to be a longer story, so it's going to span multiple episodes, but I'm going to start it here and describe my journey into where I'm at now. There's an article I wrote on LinkedIn some years ago when I moved to the podcasting platform because it has a blog section, and I called it The Director, and it's one of my most popular episodes I ever wrote, ever, including the books I wrote, the poems I wrote, ever. It's easily one of the most popular. The second one being, of course, the spring break one, which that got me flack. But regardless, The Director, if you didn't know, the reason that I got to the point that I was able to get to in the work, in the business side of things, I was working at a loan company. This is 2003 that I started at this loan company, and I was there all the way to 2008. In 2003 and just prior, so basically from the point I graduated high school up to this 2003, I was working call center jobs, and I would go from various call center jobs A to B to C because call center work at that time, we were not offshoring as much as we started doing. And chat was kind of a thing, but it wasn't a heavy thing. It was more about email responses, message boards, right? And then we start seeing more chat come up. But the core of call center was what I did for a living, which is you start the job, they're paying you to train you. We want you to learn how to do it, and we're going to pay you while we train you how to do it. You're like, wow, that's amazing. Yeah, it is, because that's the culture it was back then. They wanted to have you trained, and they wanted to have you paid. Now, when I went to this loan company in 2003, at the time, it was more money than I'd ever made in any other job outside of the phone company because the phone company had commissions. But in the loan company, in terms of base salary, there was nothing like it in how much money I was making compared to what I was making before. And it was easy. It was very easy work. You go there and they train you how to do it. And the training there was very lax. Like it was kind of, you just basically got on the floor and paired up with somebody and they talked you through different things until you got it. And then there was a team lead and they would review your files because we had physical files that you had to process until you got perfect. And then once you're perfect, you can go on your own, and then they monitor calls and give you feedback, and there's QA and all this normal stuff. But it was very unstructured, generally speaking, compared to what we have today. Anybody that works call center that's listening to this today and in the modern times in general, you have this concept of almost every one of them are using Salesforce, which drives me insane because I think Salesforce is a terrible tool compared to what we had, which was the software was built either by a consultant or internal, but regardless, it was built for the specific needs of that business. And so you needed to be trained on how to navigate the application. But because it was built around the specific needs of the business, it meant that you can optimize the navigation according to what it takes to serve the customer, as opposed to taking something monolithic like Salesforce, and then usually it's a template, and then you're trying to navigate around multiple screens. Believe me, I've used Salesforce at multiple companies for different reasons, and I think it's a terrible tool. I struggle with why anybody would use it for call center support, because I think it's a horrible tool for call center support. Call center support should be quick, should be efficient, to the point. You should be able to get the customer's problem solved, usually within a few minutes. Salesforce extends that times five, all for data collection probably, because most of these companies dump it to like Cognos or Tableau or something. So it's probably for big wigs to do the analysis data and understand how many call center reps that they need, because they're no longer doing as much offshoring, and so they're trying to justify the cost. That's my theory, but I digress. Back then, you would have an application custom built for the company, and you would learn how to navigate this application, but it was purpose-built for customer service. And so it was easy to get around the different screens. So it was easy work for me. In this company, they had different groups. You had the data entry people, whose job is to manually data enter applications because people can hand write it, because a lot of these were filled out at schools. This is less so a thing today. It's still a thing, but nowhere near what it used to be. Because it used to be that a student would go to the school, they would go into the admissions office, they would fill out the application and the master promissory note, they would submit it over as a paper file to the loan processing company. So when I say files, that's what I'm referring to. We would receive the paper files, we would put them in the folders, and they had the colored barcodes, colored barcodes and color numbered folders, just like you'd see at the doctor's office. And you get assigned files, and then you have to data enter those files into the system, issue some sort of number for this application so we can track it, and associate it to the customer's social security number, and then data entry is done. So they're doing hundreds and hundreds of these every single day as they flow in. We had one data entry guy, and he was fast, and he was efficient. He was spot on. He just put his headset on and just go to work. Then we had a loan verification person, whose job is to verify the loans that are being reported. So in our situation, we are predominantly doing consolidation loans. And so we are consolidating existing loans into a new loan. So we need to verify your existing loans are compatible and compliant with doing the new loan. So that's a group. Then we have the consolidation customer service folks, who's basically answering inquiries from the customer. We're processing the application actually through the system. Then you got the parent loans and the student loans. These are different types of loans, but it's one group that handles both. The parent loans require credit checks. The student loans do not. And then there's the actual credit group who runs credit for the parent loan side. Then you got the school side. They're the ones that talk and interact with the schools with regarding whatever's going on. Then you got the mailroom up in the back. And the mailroom, of course, is a generic term for those that create the files, create the folders, track the storage room, and et cetera. And then also open and receive the mail and process new inbound. So you have all these different groups. Now, when I started, it was a very laid back thing. You know, consolidation was easy for me. It was easy work, way easier than any other customer service position I ever had. And because it was so easy, and at the time I wanted to be really challenged, I didn't want to be bored. I didn't want to be sitting around, and I was already at the head of the class, so-called. So I wanted more out of this. So I asked to cross-train in something else. I wanted to help with the data entry because I, at the time, was able to type 120 words a minute with a 97% error rate. I'm down to 96 words a minute, of course, with the same error rate. But at the time, I was a little bit faster than what I am now. And so I wanted to help the guy out, and that would help him a little bit because he can free up and he doesn't even need to be there the full day. So I cross-trained in that one, helped him out, got really good at it. And so then when he was able to take time off, because there was only one guy at the time, so now he's able to take time off, and I'm able to fill this in, and I'm able to stay busy. Well, I wanted even more because it wasn't, at the time, it wasn't challenging work. So I asked to cross-train in loan verification, which is really easy. You're just querying a system that pretty much everybody has access to, and you're looking at the loans, and they meet certain criteria or they don't, and then you note what does or doesn't. Then you request a certificate, and the certificate comes back in some point in the future, and then it goes to data entry. So I cross-trained that one. Okay, that's easy work. It doesn't even require a lot of time. I was faster than people already doing. So then I asked to cross-train in the Plus and Stafford and the parents and the students. And this one's a little bit tricky only because the student side was easy, but the parent side, just because there's other things you got to think about beyond just the school and beyond the loan. You know, the status of the parents and how it was filed and the master promissory note, and all these things took a different form. And so I had to really crunch down to master it. It wasn't, they didn't get a lot of calls because the school side fielded many of them. But once I got in there and I realized, okay, this is a little bit different than consolidation, it wasn't hard, but it took a little bit to kind of get the groove so that I was comfortable doing any of those kinds of loans. Well, then to really understand the parent side, I needed to do cross-train to credit. Now, I had just come from a credit bureau, so I know the rules. I'm credit certified. CDIA was a credit industry certification. I held it. I understood how to read the credit reports. I understood the rules behind the credit, memorized back to forth. I get to the credit. There's one gal who's doing it, and they do this process where in order to get in and cross train, they force you to go through this test. I'm going through the test, and they're wrong. Like the answers that they're giving are wrong. They're fundamentally wrong. I tell them, no, this is wrong. That's not the rule. I can point you to the rule. It is wrong. And they didn't agree. My manager comes and says, well, this is why we wanted you to wait. No. This is not about waiting. Your test is wrong. So you may have been screening applications wrong. I can point you to the freaking law. This is wrong. Eventually I get in because they it's like, whatever. Eventually I get in there. And I'm blowing it out because I came from a credit bureau and they're not recognizing this. Like, they're not understanding. You hired me from this credit bureau. So that should have immediately told you to put me in the credit side in the first place. But regardless, here we are. So I'm cross-trained in credit. I'm cross-trained in parent, cross-trained in student, cross-trained data entry, cross-trained in loans. And I'm doing consolidations. I'm doing it all at the same time because the student and parent volume is seasonal, generally speaking. Consolidation is not seasonal, but there are so many rules behind it that many people didn't qualify. So I'm able to knock those out pretty quick. So then I go and I help in the mailroom because why not? That's easy. That's just paper filing, paper distribution, creating folders. So I'm up to date now. I learn about the school side. I don't work the school side. They have me taking a call occasionally, but I'm generally kind of just assisted. So I'm already versed in all the different core aspects at some level, whether I'm doing anything or not, but I'm versed in all of them. I've talked to many of them. Many of them I follow on LinkedIn. Now, they change leadership and we get a new director of operations. And this dude releases a stack ranking. That's what it is, a stack ranking document. Now, up to this point, I had been at the top in terms of the ranking for quality and processing apps and all this, where I was getting the bonus for the team. So this ranking comes out and it's basically criteria that says, okay, if you're in consolidation, you're this level. If you're in student, you're in this level. If you're in credit, you're in this level. School, you're in this level. So I'm looking at this, and the way it's described is basically assuming that people are doing what I just did, which is to cross-train in multiple areas and be versed in multiple things. And then it's talking about the salary, and it's going to be a pretty significant salary bump for somebody who is at the top level. Well, everybody on the floor see and know, they know, right, that I've been actively pursuing all these different groups, not knowing they were going to do this, but I'm actively out there trying to get as much of this because I'm bored, really. So then people are saying, no, he's a shoo-in because he's already cross-trained in everything that should give him the highest rank. Rankings come out, and I'm stuck in the ranking that's just consolidation, there's a guy on the floor. I'm not going to call out his name, but there's a guy on the floor who knows nothing about anything. He never did consolidation. He never did data entry. He never did mail. He never did credit, but he's put as the highest ranking. I think he was the only one. And people are like, what the heck is this? Because there were some people else that said, hey, why am I this ranking when I'm in credit? Or why am I in this ranking when I'm over here? Or this person is data entry and they're higher than me. Like, it was, there was no logic to why they rank things. But uniformly, people are like, why the heck is he at this low ranking when he is cross-trained? He's the only one cross-trained every single thing on the floor. So nobody can have an answer. My lead doesn't have an answer. My soup doesn't have an answer. Talk to the manager. And the manager, I don't really regard him very much because he didn't really manage anything. He stayed in the office, didn't do anything. But he basically said, no, just be patient, just be patient. No, it's not about a patience thing. You released this in advance. You said, this is the criteria. I met the criteria, so you need to explain to me why this doesn't work. Just be patient and take some time. Not going to work for me, brother. So then a position comes up, and it's in compliance, and I know nothing of compliance world. I've never done anything of it. It's dealing with industry regulations, and I'm pretty confident as I read it that I can do it, but I'm also confident that I'm underqualified, grossly underqualified for this business. But I have a sense that it's going to break this glass ceiling that's been imposed upon me. Now, I'm fair. I'm a negotiable person, even now. Just like I've been back then, even now, I'm willing to negotiate when things aren't right to make it right, but it has to be 50-50. You're not going to steamroll me. Even back then, I was thinking this way. So I met with this director of ops dude who released this structure, and I said, I need you to explain why I was not here. And his answer, I don't want to cuss, but his answer was nonsense. His answer made no sense. His answer was basically an excuse, and it was clear that there was some discriminatory business going on that I couldn't prove. I couldn't prove it, but it was obvious because I was the only one on the floor cross-trained in the stuff. So either the criteria is wrong, because you got a guy over here who's cross-trained in nothing who got the highest rank. Either it's favoritism or discrimination, can only be one of the two. I can't prove which it is or isn't. And so rather than try to fight it, I went ahead and applied for this compliance position. Now, I got a call back from the director, who is the director I wrote about and the person who made me the person that I became, and for calling for an interview. And I met with the person who was going to be the manager of this person, this role, because apparently this person was slammed and couldn't keep up. And I didn't think much of the guy, right, that was going to be the manager, but it was a cool interview. There was no problems with the interview itself. I just didn't think much of the person. It seemed like he was going through the motions, really, and just wanted to get somebody. Like, I didn't get the sense he was really screening. Get to the director, who's the requirement. Every person who applies has to eventually meet with the director, and she's kind of testing your personality and your potential and whether you're a fit, really. And sometimes she got it wrong. But as I meet with her and I'm talking to her and she says, well, why did you apply for this? And I said, I see I can do it. I wasn't going to because it looks like I don't qualify, but I can do what's here. Pretty sure I can. I just got to have the right resources to do it. Well, why do you want to leave there? And I told her the truth. It's like they're screwing me out of what I was entitled. And I don't think that's right. And I'm not going to stay there and be misused, and they can't give me a firm answer. If they gave me an answer that I could absorb, then I wouldn't mind staying. And she was very respectful of the fact that I'm in a position where I've got to get out for my own future. I can't just stay there and be abused like this. So she's like, yep, I like it. I'm gonna go ahead and approve that. So they give me an offer, and it's a lateral move offer, which I didn't expect that. I assumed it'd be a raise, but apparently the policy of the company was to do lateral moves, which drove me nuts. But I was so gung-ho about getting out of there that I didn't even care. It's like, I want out of here. I don't want to stay here. That's not going to work for me. Like, I was so unmotivated by this point, where I was, I would have been anywhere else. It wouldn't have mattered what it was. I would have done janitorial at this point. So I get the offer. I go ahead and accept the offer. Yep. So now I give some notice. It's a 2-week plan for me to transition. And so I've transitioned my files. I'm not needing to train anybody, but I got to transition my files. I have to make sure that there's nothing outstanding for me. And so then I get called in to the manager's office. Well, how come you're leaving? I said, I told you I'm leaving. You did not give me the answer to the question regardless. And I wasn't accepting the answer that you gave me. So I'm going somewhere else that's going to appreciate me. Get called in by the director of ops, this dude that released the structure. I want to understand why you're leaving. I already told you, I told him, you guys, this is easy to solve. My acceptance of this gets torn up. All you got to do is give me the rating that I earned. That's all you got to do. Make this right. I can't. Okay, then I'm out of here. This dude, after I did the transition and I'm starting in the new role, this dude revoked. He arbitrarily one-sided revoked the bonus that I had earned because I was supposed to get the quarterly bonus because I had the top stats just before I left. And I was supposed to get the Christmas bonus just before I left. He revoked them both. He said, you're not getting the bonuses, which was crap. We know this. So then when I get over to the compliance side, and she's aware of this because she's in directors. She's basically his peer. And she's aware of this, and she says, no, that's garbage. You're going to get it. And she funds it. She makes sure that I get my bonuses. So now I'm in the situation where I'm in this new department and they're taking care of me, right? They're trying to see to me. They're trying to see that I'm taking well care of. And it's not about just them, right? So I appreciated that. And that told me I made a good move here. I did the right thing because it was no longer about me doing all this work and getting nothing to show for it. Obviously, I got a bonus before, but I wanted more. I wanted to be recognized. I wanted to go up. I wanted to get more responsibility, and I wanted to be recognized for that responsibility, and I wanted to see it in terms of pay raise. None of that ever happened in the position I was in. So I get to this new one, and she makes the bonus happen, and then she gives me the first task, which is basically I have to build a portal for the executives, and she wants it in 2 weeks. Okay. Now, this is different than what I was told I was going to be doing, but I'm okay with it. But it's still different in my mind. I'm like, I got to figure out how to do this because while I had worked some code, I had never done it to the point that I'm exposing it to an executive team. This is a totally different paradigm of code, you know, build. I had done simple portals. I'd done IRC builds. I'd done some JavaScript and HTML. I had never done things with authentication. I'd never done things with document delivery. And so I had to figure out, what am I going to do to structure this? Because I wanted to give a good impression and I wanted to excel. I wanted to surpass her expectations because of what she'd just done, right? So I'm figuring things out and I'm juggling in my head and I'm like, okay, I need a way to scan docs. So I need this multifunction printer for myself because I'm going to need to dedicate scan. I'm going to need to have some server space, and I'm going to need to have, you know, some ways to write the code, the software I need this. And she gets it all done. And then we're doing, now mind you, at the time we're in the CRT monitors. We're not at the flat screen monitors. So we're in old times here. And, you know, we have to upgrade to dual monitors across the board. There's a lot that has to be done to enable this to be useful and successful. Get this done. And then I start searching around. And I stumble across some templates for sites that are just basically portals. It just gives you an authentication and you authenticate to it. And then in the back end, you can access whatever you want. So you can secure things. I was spinning it up, got it on the server, got it working on basically a server that lived up in that compliance department, which wasn't good, but it was the only way I could do it. And I'll get to that in a second. But it was functional and it worked and it did what she wanted. It did exactly what she wanted it to do. I had everything captured into a PDF document, including many of the old contracts, none of which had been scanned. Some of them were close to damage because they were old. And so we were able to create that digital archive so that now we can preserve these for however long we need to. And she's impressed with it. She's impressed with what I'm doing. The manager that I'm reporting to is a little bit pissed off because, you know, I'm being more called to do these types of tasks, these one-off things that she knows the department needs, and she sees that I'm capable of doing them. Now, before I get to what happens next, this is going to be my first break point. My summary of what happened there and the reason I preface with that story, I've always been the kind who I'm willing to work with you, but it's got to be 50-50. I will not be ripped off or cheated. And to be fair, in jobs after this one, I did allow myself to be cheated a little bit because the pay was higher. And then I stopped doing that because I should have reverted back to the way I was, which was, I'm not going to allow you to steamroll me. I'm not going to allow you to abuse me. I'm not going to allow you to cheat me. I'm going to be 50-50. We're going to have to figure that out and get to the point where the employer whichever employer, whether it's a full-time or a contract employer, is going to need to work with me 50-50 so that we both get value out of the relationship. Because that's the key of it. If I don't feel it, I'm going to leave. If you don't feel it, you should want me to leave. If you're going to try to keep me, you have to reflect on why I'm leaving, which means you need to fix the reason that I'm leaving. And that's been a shortfall in every single company I've ever been at, is they act like they're surprised when I leave, but then it's like, I told you why I was going to leave. Why didn't you fix it? Well, we can't. Okay, then you shouldn't be surprised that I'm leaving because you refused to work with me 50-50. So that was my big revelation back then that I lost. I stopped focusing on it, and I should have kept focusing on it because it really was the right answer. How do I get back to that one? That's where I'm going next, to try to figure out how do I get back into that groove of just owning my own professional relationship so that I can be successful but also valuable to the company. So now I'm in the mix. I'm in this new job, and I've been able to appeal to this director, doing the impossible, crash course on how to learn VB.net, building a portal that I'd never done before, doing document imaging to a degree that I didn't even touch before. I was not trained on how to do any of this stuff at all. So there are other tasks she gives me, things like maintain the break room. I got to work with the HR folks when we changed our coffee makers, because what we would do before, which is still common in other companies, and I can't understand this, but what they would do before is they would have one of those big machines that have different burners, right? And so you have different pots. So there's a pot for your regular Colombian and a pot for decaf and then a pot for whatever other garbage people wanted. And then coffee would be wasted because then you have to brew multiple different types of coffee for different people. So they got a Flavia machine, and Flavia was a, I don't know if they're still active, I think they are. Flavia was a, basically it's a pod-based machine, and they were doing samples, and I was delegated to participate on behalf of compliance to sample this machine and see if it's something that we could fit and to decide which coffees we were going to get for the department, because I had the best knowledge, believe it or not, of the different coffees people wanted and people preferred. I knew that the director loved her coffee as black as it gets, no cream, no sugar, just the strongest coffee I could find, which was Sumatra in the Flavia world. And then most people preferred either decaf or Colombia. And then some people like the flavored, like hazelnut, for example. Some people like French roast. Like I was a French roast person. Some people like Irish cream, the coffee. So I got to select the and sample the machine. They did the installation. I got to oversee that. I got to be involved with it. And then just oversee the supply and stock when the guy would come around and provide all the break room supplies. And of course, when you do the corporate contract for like Flavia, they'll bring you the creamers, the stirrers, the cups, the everything. They do the whole break room other than the water, which is a different thing. And so this was a unique experience because it meant that, okay, I can kind of help coordinate the departmental needs. Whatever the department needs, I can help make sure we get it, because that was lacking. We didn't have like an administrative assistant like you might have in some departments, like in IT. They'll usually have an admin who oversees that kind of stuff. We didn't have that. So for me, I liked doing this. I enjoyed it. It was something that I preferred doing. I didn't want to just be doing the same thing. Again, goes back to getting bored. I didn't want to do the same thing every single time. I wanted to kind of diversify. So I took on the task of overseeing the water as well, making sure we ordered enough water, just enough water, because we were built for it, just enough water to accommodate the needs of the department so that we didn't have excessive amounts of bottles and we were never understocked and we could place one-off orders if we needed extra water, like say if we had a, you know, some kind of party or something. She would also do things like, you know, every month we would order food on behalf of the department, order lunch for everybody. And the joke is she and I were the only two people that enjoyed the best food that there was to order, which was at the time Boston Market, who of course evacuated the West Coast, which is stupid. And I'm promising and committing to you here, right now, that based on the things that I'm doing here, I have one of my bucket list items is to bring Boston Market back to the West Coast. I don't know what state, but I will be. I am committed to bringing Boston Market back to the West because it is arguably, you know, I'm suffering a Cracker Barrel and Marie Callender right now. None of them compare to what Boston Market brought, especially around Thanksgiving, but I digress. So Everybody, they always wanted Chinese food, Panda Express, which I thought was garbage, or they wanted pizza, which is boring, or something else. They never wanted this Boston Market except me and her. And there were some people, they'd eat it, it's fine, but for whatever reason, they just wanted the garbage, you know, the simple food. So then I'm the one that's placing the order, and I'm taking the orders of what people want and the survey of people want. And so everybody knows, you know, when it comes time to do that, I'm basically the one that's making it happen on behalf of the team. I also would handle the break room, not the break room, but the actual supply room. We had a supply section that was around a pillar that was kind of useless space, and I reallocated this for supplies, and I got a cabinet, ordered a cabinet there, reorganized the supplies so that we had everything that we need. And again, keep in mind, we don't have anybody who's doing this, so it needed to be done. It didn't matter. Like, I didn't think of it as low-level work. I looked at it as something different to do, so I'm not bored with the same thing I was doing. I wanted to diversify and do as much as I could to add value to that department and to the company overall, because the more efficient that we are as a unit, the more we can serve our other business customers out there. So then, fast forward a little bit, and the company starts talking about getting into content management. Content management, of course, is, at the time, predominantly dealing with digital document delivery to people so that you can be more efficient. And that was the sales pitch when they came to the company, whoever it was, sold them on the idea. And I'm pretty sure it was Latitude 44. Guy's name is Dan Lean. He passed away a couple of years ago. He was the one that came, and I'm pretty sure he did the pitch. I wasn't there on the initial pitch, but I know that he was assigned. So I'm assuming he had to be involved in some of the sales talks, but they did it predominantly around the department I just left with the consolidation loans because of the paper files. And this was logical. That made sense. They did need to get into the modern era because many of the different companies that were doing what we were doing were already in digital document delivery of some kind. We had an army of developers. I want to say there had to have been at least 100 people in IT. A lot of developers. I never met the vast majority of them directly, but I know we had a lot of them. And for the life of them, they couldn't seem to get a content system built, and they couldn't seem to get integrations done. And our IT was very resistant to working with external vendors. And I never understood that, but they were patently resistant against it. So when this thing comes around, the what we called loan ops, because that's where I used to work, they were really excited because they wanted to get away from paper files. And the mail room, all you had to do was basically scan it, and it goes to the rep, and we can do auto assignments and all this potential, right? And I'm stressing the word potential. I'll get back to that in a second. But then compliance, you know, our director, she's like, and this surprised me, but she's like, yep, we need to get on it. Okay, I'm cool with that. I think it's a good idea. We deal with paper files too, and there's other opportunities that we see that we could leverage as well. And so she delegates me to basically represent the department in the RFP process. And so we're going to evaluate a number of different vendors in the RFP and then settle on which one seems to meet the needs. And pretty much loan ops is going to be making the final decision because they have more votes in play. There was a future plan to do human resources, finance, and other departments, but initially it was going to be loan operations and compliance. So now there's an advantage for me because I've been in both departments. I know the ins and outs of both departments, and I can help in both sides. Now, around this time, this dude that cheated me in the loan ops, all we get is an email that flew out one day from the CEO that said, I have accepted the resignation of. And so that's cool. There was nothing else to it, but I'm happy to see this idiot out of there because I'm thinking, okay, maybe the department's going to get some better stride. Unfortunately, it turns out the leadership was even worse. The new one, he's a nice guy, but I'm saying that generally speaking, the leadership got worse. It was not, they went a totally different direction than I expected them to, and they didn't revert the stack rank at all, as I understand it. It was still not putting people where they needed to be. So when I say leadership, I'm not talking about a person. I'm talking about the structure. That I don't think ever improved. That this guy, the damage this guy caused, it either they couldn't break it or they didn't want to, but it was a damaging structure that should have been. So then I'm going to be basically representing compliance, pretty much solo exclusive. And we do the RFP. Now, here's where it gets fun, and here's where my segmentation starts, right? The companies that are in this that I can recall, I definitely recall FileNet, which at the time was IBM. I definitely recall Documentum, which at the time was EMC. I definitely remember Highland OnBase, of course. I remember LiveLink, which is OpenText, and the LiveLink product is still there, but LiveLink's the product, OpenText is the company. I remember Singularity, and I forget the company. I think it was Hershey. I remember those. That's all I remember. There might have been one other one, but those are the ones I remember. So I have to sit in the demo. So they come in and they do the demonstration of how they're going to solve the business problems. And there was no real discovery done during this. We did ask them questions about, this is what we're doing here. How would you solve that? And what would you recommend here? But there was no deep root discovery, which I think was a mistake. They didn't start with understanding what we needed to determine which platforms to have do that, because FileNet was too much. Documentum was too much. I know this now, but at the time I didn't know it. It didn't matter because I thought FileNet looked like garbage. I thought Documentum looked like garbage. I think everybody universally thought those two looked like garbage. So they were never going to win it. And they're blatantly overexpensive for what we had budgeted and set aside, which I didn't know that number. So to me, I thought it was a waste of time having them in the room, and it was a symptom of them not doing proper analysis, which I'm doing this as a process too. I'm learning how I can evaluate how to do an RFP and how to evaluate vendors. And like, I'm absorbing this as tools that I can possibly use in the future. And believe me, I did. So Hershey comes in, and with Hershey, they, as per the name, they brought in a whole bunch of Hershey Kisses on the table, try to impress us. I thought the tool was garbage. Then there's OpenText, LiveLink, Highland OnBase. Okay, so then with LiveLink, I thought it was a beautiful tool. I thought it was something I could easily train users on. It's web only, pretty much, and it seemed like it flowed better for what we would need. With OnBase, their workflow was very powerful. I thought it was the best workflow of all of them, bar none. But I wasn't impressed with the interface. It was, at the time, it was a very, very tedious, very old-looking interface that I thought was going to be very difficult for users to embrace. Now, to be fair, it was no older than the tools that Operations was using by far. It was basically the same technology, C#, I believe, but or C++, sorry. But it just, for me, compared to LiveLink, if I looked at them side by side, LiveLink is like Tesla compared to OnBase being a Ford Escort. Like, it was not close in what I saw and the potential for it and the future state vision. But OnBase's workflow was bar none superior to everybody else's. So that's what everybody resonated with in the op side, was the workflow. Workflow assignments and routing and queues and timers and all these things, which are powerful things. But in my mind, I'm still saying this is not going to go over well because it's going to be hard to train people on this thing. They're not going to embrace it. They're not going to adopt it in its current form. And I frankly think it sucks, not because of the workflow, but because of the interface. I'm all about user interface, which again, I'm absorbing this as a potential skill. How do I evaluate user interfaces? How do I know that this is going to be embraced by users? It doesn't matter how powerful it is. I need to know that it's going to be something my users are going to take to, because if they don't take to it, it doesn't matter how powerful it is. So we do the vote across the forum, and OnBase won by a very slim margin. I voted for LiveLink, so I'm basically the earth shatterer, but OnBase wins by a very slim margin because there's more people in Operations, and I'm that's fine. It is what it is. So I'll make the best of it. Latitude 44 comes in. Dan Lean himself comes in, and initially he does kind of this kickoff, and he's just introducing what we're going to do, and we're going to start with Operations, then we're going to go to compliance. Now, around this time, he had stopped by and he talked to me and he introduced me to the software and how it works, and he wanted to get it set up. And we agreed with the director that, yeah, we're going to get me set up in it so I can get kick the tires on it, crash course, learn this. So because we're going to be building solutions in compliance, and I need to be basically going to be their tier one support, as well as doing ongoing development. Like, we have really lofty visions for what I'm going to do with this. So he gives me the HASP, and for anybody who's in OnBase or was in OnBase from the old school, they remember the old HASPs, but basically it's a USB deal that plugs into your computer, and you had to run some software. It's from Aladdin, And it's like a DRM. It basically approves the use of their configuration tools at that time. They've since went away from it, but at the time, that was the only way he could get in to configure the thing. And he couldn't get the HASP to work, and he couldn't get the software to work, which was a big problem back then. He couldn't get to work. And he was fighting it for, at least 30 minutes, and he couldn't get to work. So I tried some things, and I'm like, maybe it's this over here, and I tried this over here, and I ran it. Basically, I changed the install order. He was doing it to where you plug the HASP in, install the software, and it should work. And it should. But what I did is I removed it, removed the driver, installed the software, restarted, then plugged the HASP in. And then I got it working. And he's like, well, it's not clear. That's basically what he said. So hilarious. But that was my best memory of him, was when he was fighting the HASP. He's a good guy. So I get in and I'm playing around, and it's just a bunch of menus. So menus are easy for me because menus are visual. Visual means I can figure it out. They had documentation. You can access the docs when you are a customer. I was able to get it in, get all set up, and everything was all fine. So then I have to wait. But we agreed then that I could go ahead and start pre-building some solutions like document types and keyword types. So that helps me learn too, because we had a test system and I was able to kick the tires, and I said, okay, this is easy work. I'll just do, because I knew the requirements of our contracts because I built the contract library, which is the previous initiative she gave me. So I already knew what types of documents we need and the structure, and I was comfortable going and doing it. So he's like, yep, go and do it. Okay, so I'm building off compliance while he's taking care of loan ops. One day I get a call into a meeting, and it's with him and the ops team, but I need to be listening in because it's basically a state of the address type thing. It's an update where we are with the installation and the process for workflows, because we do want workflows and compliance as well. So we need to know what the heck's going on as well. I go to the meeting, and who's now the chief operating officer. It's not that director idiot. He's gone. Now it's a chief operating officer. Great guy. He's leading this. He's kind of spearheading. And then, you know, Dan is in the room and he's giving the updates. And the COO, he's like, okay, I want workflow, and I want this, and I want this, and I want this, and I want them in, like, I think he said like a month or something. Some crazy aggressive thing. And Dan's, my second memory of Dan, Dan's like, well, that's ambitious. I'm direct quoting. Exactly what he said. That was the last time I saw Dan. That was the last time I saw him, because apparently that answer didn't go over very well with the COO, and they said, no, that's not going to work, and we're going Highland Direct, which means that there's no more Latitude 44 in the picture, and we need Highland to come in and take over and get us back up where we need to go. So Highland takes over the contract. They're now direct support, and we remain direct support for the duration that I was there. And they sent out some folks to see me, who I'm on LinkedIn. Great person. Stacy DeShield on LinkedIn. Great person. And Rob, I forget his last name. Rob was the installer. So they sent basically an army out. And Tasime's basically, as I'm told, he told the story later that apparently we were his first, you know, actual assignment going out in the field and doing the configuration, everything else. And then working with Stacy and everything, so they're talking about the project and getting back on track, and Tasime is going to be on site, and he's going to work with us, and Rob's going to get the server where it needs to be and get everything all cleaned up, and Tasime is then going to start doing analysis and business requirements. And see, I said before that them not doing the requirements up front was a critical mistake. I maintain it was a critical mistake. I can say this now because in hindsight, it was just so bad. It didn't mean that OnBase couldn't do it. It meant that Highland had a harder job, and I think some of the knowledge got lost, because it turns out, I didn't know this at the time, but it turns out the person who initially had introduced Highland to us was a friend of the COO. That's okay, except that there was knowledge that didn't get transferred somewhere in the equation, and then when Latitude came in, there was some understanding made there. So this guy met Latitude, and then Latitude and this guy exchanged information, and they came to an agreement about what they were going to do. And at the time, they thought it was just loan ops, and compliance threw a wrench in things. And then timeline was a bit sketchy because they didn't do analysis up front. Like, it was a whole big, I think, cross-wire communication problem. So when Hyland comes in, and Tasiva comes in, he started in loan ops, and he got them to a point where they could actually use the product and scan files and work the consolidation. I think he did consolidation, and I'm sure he did the credit workflow, and I think he might have done a plus Stafford workflow, as I recall. I know he did loan ops first, and he was there for a while, and then he came over to consolidation. And, of course, he's checking in with me, and how's it going? And I'm like, you know, I'm in. I got my doc type set up, and we're all good, but now we have to do the borrower services side because they want to get on. Basically, they had an access database that the husband of the supervisor had created and then gave it to them, and I was kind of patching it and keeping it running, but this on-base thing was going to replace it. And QA hadn't figured out exactly what they wanted to do, but we thought that we were possibly going to do some of the forms that they were doing the evaluations from. But QA was going to be second. Borrower services was kind of at the top. And then the contracts, I was going to move my library into OnBase fully. Now that I've got Tasima here, then we got to figure out how that plays in. Do we do a flow? Do we do what do we need to do? So I settled on, let me just get the docs imported, which for me is a manual process and didn't need to be. Let me get the docs imported. I'll set up the contract side over here, just help them with the borrower services and the requirements for that, because I get the sense it's going to take you a while. So he's working with the borrower services team. And there, again, it's an access database they're replacing. Now, everything is all clear in hindsight. I can go back and say there were some things that we could have done better as a department to prepare for his arrival, including myself. But I didn't know enough about the product. I didn't know enough about the potential of the product and the module that we really needed, we didn't own, but I didn't know its power because Hyland never marketed it for what it should have been, because that would have been perfect for them. So he's working with them, and I remember Tasime's go-to phrase the entire time he's in the meetings is, yeah, because Borrower Services was just hitting him with all sorts of crazy, you know, fields need to do this and buttons need to do that and we need tabs need to appear, disappear, all sorts of crazy stuff, which culminated into, I believe, it was this elaborate electronic form to collect the data because theirs was all about data collection. They didn't need the, there were, again, this is one of those things that we could have done better as a department. They needed access to the loan file and we knew the loan file was already in the system. What we didn't do is we didn't correlate the two automatically. So the user would still have to go and query for the files that they needed in order to view it and create a file. And we were still creating paper files. We could have streamlined that process, but I didn't know enough about how the file was being archived on the ops side. And once I learned about it, there was no way for us to automatically link it because they didn't do enough keywords, which if we had known enough, we could have told them, ideally, we should put more keywords in this thing so that we can make this process more seamless because there's a natural evolution from loan ops up to borrower services. Basically, the moment the file is created, we know who the student is, we know who the applicant is, we know their background history, all that data, as well as where they are in the system and the process from sales all the way through. Once we get to borrower services, the linkage changes. So we still know the people, but now we're creating a case around them, which is a one to many. So a person can call us multiple times with different complaints, but they're all linked to the person record, not to the application record. And so that's where the flow should have been optimized. And I didn't think at the time that that was even possible because I didn't know enough. Tasime being new and the fact that we didn't give him proper requirements, he wouldn't have known to ask. So then borrower services, we build this elaborate form. And there's all sorts of issues. And so we're having to go back and keep modifying it all this time, not realizing that basically we had the wrong solution, not because he built the wrong solution, but because we told him something that wasn't really the need. What we really needed was the WorkView module. And if we had WorkView, it'd have been perfect. It would have done exactly what we needed and then link it to workflow to where the moment a borrower needs to escalate, that's what borrower services did, we can hit a button and it automatically pulls in the case file and all the relevant documents to that file. And we can attach it without having to rely on keywords to do it. We know that now, but at the time there was not enough information to tell Tasime, okay, this is what I think we're really trying to get at. And the form he built, and there was a lot of code in it. And then we had to manage this. And then they ultimately reverted to kind of a hybrid. They were still using the access database to some degree and for historical reference, and then they had this one here. We tried to do some imports and things, and they just didn't go clean. So I'm learning as I go. I'm learning this, okay, there's got to be a better way. And that's always my mantra. There's got to be an easier way to do this. Fast forward a little bit. The company starts layoffs because the industry's changing. Cuomo, who's now out of office finally, but Cuomo at the time, he's doing investigations and he's trying to figure out what's going on with the Fed, the student loans and all these private companies that are doing student loans. And he's making these allegations about impropriety and fraud and all these things that had no evidence, and he's trying to find it, right? And he circles it around something that was common at the time, and it was common at the time, of around the preferred lender list, which was at the school level, you basically have these loan companies that go to the various schools and they say, here's our program, here's our benefits for your students, and here's why you should send them to us, and then here's how we take care of them. And as a result, then the school would create a preferred lender list that says, you can apply wherever you want, but here are the ones we prefer that you go to for whatever reason that prefer. It was the prefer that caused the big fur, because it's like, wait a minute, how are you determining that preference? And it turned out that there were certain companies that were doing some really bad stuff. Now, there were some things that were kind of sketchy, right? About whether they were really overly bad or just kind of whatever. Things, for example, you'd get school officials and picking them up with a limo, right, from the airport because you wanted to have them a ride to whatever location. Or, you know, dinners. Sometimes there were kickbacks. Sometimes there were whatever. And they never drew a line during that whole investigatory process. They never drew a line around, okay, what are you really having a problem with? Because picking somebody up at the airport, why is that an issue as a question? They never answered it. They didn't care. What they wanted was not to have a preferred lender list at all. They wanted to have this, basically the school not make any preference, not make any recommendation, and just have the student decide. The problem with this, as people learn later, the student doesn't know where to go. And so what you would see is that many of these companies would then start advertising on like TV or something, and they would say the same thing that they would say to the school. But the student wouldn't know where to go because, again, at this time, you were going into the office. You were going into the financial aid office and saying, I need to get aid for this. I don't know where to go, right? Today, it's different. When you want financial aid, it's pretty much coming from the same company, which is the direct, you know, government, and it's getting farmed out to the same servicer, which is now aid, whatever, used to be a different company. But it wasn't like that back then. Back then, you had a choice. You could choose which lender that you wanted to have your loans processed through. And your distincting factor was going to be the benefits they offered you, which was, did they offer rebates on certain things? Did they offer loan reductions after a certain number of payments? Just like the free market on regular loans outside of the student loan industry, same kind of benefits that were offered, and you as a student could choose, but you wouldn't know where to go. So you would have to do a lot more research in order to find which one makes sense for you. That's the whole origin of the preferred lender list. So when he's doing this investigation, and basically, like I said, in summary, they were trying to get rid of the idea of preferred lenders. They didn't want it. They wanted to have the student be forced into a single choice. The outcry of this resulted in many of them leaving the industry because the regulations changed. And I don't want to bore you with the regulations, but suffice it to say that the changes in the regulations, basically a private company could do those loans now. You could still go back in the industry now, but it's not profitable because of the way they made the changes. So because it's no longer profitable, they basically evacuated and said, okay, we're not doing it because there's no money to be made in it anymore. And the way that this then affected the industry is you as a student going to college, or your kid as students going to college, you no longer have any choice as to who is going to give you a loan. And you no longer have the benefits that you had at one point. You just get the loan and that's it. So there's no officer. Some of them, sometimes the servicer might do a one-off thing that says, hey, if you make the next couple payments, we'll cut it a little bit, but they're rare. Used to be that it's like, you know, you make your first 24 payments and we'll cut your rate down by 1%. Well, that's huge. That could be hundreds of thousands of dollars of savings over the life of the loan. Or if it's a consolidation loan, you might get a rebate. Right, of a certain amount of the principal. That's huge because, again, it cuts down payments over the life of the loan. None of that's available now because of that investigation. So when they do this, and I'm directly seeing why they're doing it, and I'm seeing what the concern is, and I'm seeing what their issue is and all this kind of stuff. But it doesn't make sense to me because, you know, you had so much benefit from the student's side in having that choice, and now it's taken away. I say that as somebody who's gone through the process from both sides. I know how the experience was in both ends, and I don't think it's a better experience for the student. But when that happened, then this loan company says, okay, we got to start leaving this because it's not financially proper for us to stay in it. So they start layoffs. And with the layoffs, they pretty much focused on IT first, and they gutted IT. IT got completely destroyed, and I don't even think they had developers left. And so now you got the software, and it's buggy and all this stuff. They start with IT. Now, the interesting thing, and it's both sad and interesting, but the interesting thing here is with the IT group, they had the IT folks. We spun up a new building, and if anybody remembers Gateway Computers used to be out in Poway, and they had bought the Gateway building to have as our own building for the first time because they were renting in a shared space, in a lease space, and we wanted to have our own building. Of course, it's still owned by the Gateway company, but it's going to be basically dedicated to this loan company. And so they bought the building, and they gutted it, and they redesigned it, and then they set up and they had IT go out and do all the wiring and everything else. Immediately after we move in, so like shortly after we move in, then they do the layoffs of IT. And the problem, they had hired like a deli. There was a deli guy in that center. They had hired him to come run a deli inside this building, which is actually good food, but they did all this stuff, and then they laid off the IT groups. Now, after they laid off the IT groups, then they do, you know, the town hall, and they're telling people it's tough times, but we're holding tough. We got good reserves, but we're going to have to slim up a little bit. We're making smart moves, but we're healthy. You don't worry about it. Then they do layoffs of operations. Now, in the operations side, there were rumors that certain people asked to be laid off that would not have been laid off. I don't know if that's true or not, but the point is, many of the people that got laid off were in positions that were in charge of many of the solutions that had been created in OnBase down there for when Highland was there. So after all these people leave, the new people that get in front that are taking charge of these groups now, they know I'm involved in OnBase because we're in those meetings, right? And so they reach out to me and they're saying, you know, we got this issue. They're asking us about who can we lay off, basically. And we need to evaluate these solutions to try to figure out how can we find savings? How can we find efficiency? How can we prove or disprove that we do need more people or don't need more people? Or what do we have and what can we do with it? Okay, so I take a look, and it turns out that they've got a number of solutions. They built a solution around credit for sure, and they had somewhat built a solution around consolidation, but it wasn't fully working. And then they built a somewhat solution around Plus Stafford, but it wasn't really working. The one that was really functionally working and being used was the credit one, which makes sense to me because credit has different statuses that you would need to position and watch. So we look at the credit one, and I'm doing meetings with the person that's overseeing this. And I'm looking at the credit one, and it doesn't make sense how it's built at all. They basically took the paper file process and copied it into the system. It's not efficient, and it's a waste of time. It's basically person goes in, they manually pull a file, and then they work it, and they manually close it. Everything's a manual. It's just like the paper file process. And so I'm asking, well, why is it built like that? And they said, well, that's what they asked for. And so that's wrong. Like, you're not efficient with this. It's wasting your time. And it's, if they're telling you that they're slammed and they're behind, that's not true. Remember, I used to work there. I know the problem here. It's, we shouldn't be allowing them to pull a file. It should automatically give it to them. That's a time savings. Then we should put an SLA on top of them that says you got to process it in a certain amount of time so it gets out automatically, or it alerts people and alerts you when they're behind. Then I guarantee you're going to see more efficient use of this tool. So I put together in the test environment a mock scenario, what I'm thinking, and a new workflow process in OnBase that says, no, I'm going to get rid of all these excess queues. You don't need them. I'm going to automatically assign the work in order to everybody because that's basically how we assign the files. It's just that it was a person doing it, but the software can do it now. So I will automatically assign you files in order. I'm not going to show any preferential treatment. I'm not going to let you manually choose the file, and I'm not going to let you manually remove the file. It's going to go to your queue. After, I think I said you know, 48 hours or whatever, then I'm going to alert the supervisor and you that this is behind. You got to work it. And I think they must have had like 15 people, 12 to 15 people in this department, which I thought was crazy because our volume for the credit processing had gone down. We did have private loans, but these were predominantly coming from the parent loan side. So it didn't make any sense to have that many people. We had never had that many people in the parent or even the credit. This was done by one person before. It didn't make any sense. So I said, okay, let me do this. I'll run you through it. Talked her through it. She's like, I like it. Let's go with it. I'm a little bit concerned that they're going to freak out. And I said, you want them to freak out because the fact that they're complaining now means they're comfortable because they think that there's too much work because all they're doing is looking at the number in the queue. They're not looking at the fact that they actually should be processing this stuff. So they're focusing in the wrong direction. We take that away and take away the ability to make themselves inefficient. So we go live with this workflow. Immediately we're getting complaints. Okay, we don't like this. Why are we doing this? Why can't I manually pull files? Why is it automatically sending me files? I got too much in my queue. About a week or 2 weeks passes. The queue's empty, near empty. File comes in, process quick. They're way more efficient. They were able to cut half the staff because you didn't need that many people. Your process was just broken in the software. When I built that one and I saw how successful and how easy it was just to kind of shift the paradigm, right? That's when I realized this on-base thing's got something to it and I want to be in this. I like this. I like doing this. I like doing that kind of stuff. I was able to do that workflow, revise is basically a rewrite for the credit. I was able to do a new workflow with a different person, Cynthia, and basically that was a QA. They did an internal QA process where we did digital forms, and I thought that one was pretty cool. And then the biggest one, arguably the most complex thing I ever created, maybe, we had, so I talked about the rebate process with consolidations. The way that that worked is once you made the payments, you would need to call in either to your sales rep, because you could always call your sales rep, or to a call center customer service and request the form. And then the form goes to you, and then you fill it out and you mail it in, and then we manually process it through the system. And then it goes to finance to pay it out. So this was an ongoing thing, an ongoing problem, and an ongoing need, because we consolidation was arguably our biggest volume. So we're always processing these loans. Well, there's a lot of research that went along with it. We had to understand whether your qualification was true by number of payments. So we had to check number of systems. And it was a whole big, it was a very inefficient process that involved multiple people. Every time we processed one, you're talking one person from like five different departments involved just to make it, just to process this thing. And so somebody had the brilliant idea of taking the data that we had in Cognos, which was a dump of all servicing, all origination, all of our internal ops, and using that to automate the review process as well as the decisioning process so that we can slim it down. And then all you really needed at that point was the mailroom who receives the form, scan it into the system so that we have it as a document for that process point. Index it with some keywords that we can use to process it on the back end, and then add it to a queue. On the sales side, we create a digital form. The sales rep on the phone can literally fill in the form right on the fly. You don't need to send them a paper form because they don't need it as long as we talk to them. Same with customer service. So we put this electronic form out there, and then for the paper form, we have a scan and index process to make sure we capture the right data points. The electronic form fills in the keys for you, so it's the faster way to do it. But once we get all these forms collected, then we're going to create a queue that's going to centralize all these together as a single source of all this data every day, and then collect it up. And I think we did a monthly run. I believe it was a monthly run. But we collected up, might have been weekly. But we collected up, we create a single file, which is what we're going to do with all the data of all the qualifiers, the ones that we need to run through this tool. The developer on the Cognos side, she built an engine. It was kind of like the earliest form of AI that took this data and it ran through all the different points of information in the system, and it knew how to decision it based on the decision tree. Now, you think this is a simple matter, but the way the rebate process worked, the rules for qualification changed every single time. So every time the sales or marketing group would create a new promotion, we had a different criteria for the rebate. So it might be after 6 on-time payments, or it might be after 9 on-time payments. It might be a 1% rebate or a 2% rebate. there are different criteria. And so she had to tell it based on the date that you're applying, based on the date of the loan, based on the date of the payments. Like, all these different dates have to be calculated and considered against what the promotion would have been at that time for your qualification, and then spit out a decision. Well, you could have sometimes people that apply too early. Should be 6 on-time payments or at the 5th payment. So it needs to know you haven't yet made the, it's a 6 payments and you haven't made the 6th payment. Or it's a 9 payments, you made 6 because you thought it was 6, but it's actually 9 because of when you applied, right? All of this elaborate logic to figure it out, it's all in Cognos that we're talking. So she builds this amazing engine. And this was a joint effort between myself, the Cognos developer, and a business analyst, brilliant young lady, to figure out what do we need this to do? At the end of the day, what should it do? And the thought was, we should be able to simplify collecting the data from the user. We should be able to automate decisioning the data from our internal tools so that we can give cleaner files to the finance folks to send the check out. Then we should be able to provide status information back to customer service and to sales, because that was a gap that we had. So I built a queue and a workflow that was able to receive the forms, and it had some VB scripting that would generate an extract file from all and strip all the index data, send it to a single file that sent it over to a folder that the Cognos was monitoring. Cognos would take the file, it would decision each and every one, it would update the column at the back with the decision on the back end, and if it was approved, it would give me the amount of the check that we were going to pay. It would send that file back to me in the folder, when I say me, OnBase would then monitor for this. It would pull it in. Then I used a different process. I believe that was DIP. Different process to parse this file and generate e-forms that look like a rendition of a check and fill in the data points for the checks. If it was not approved, it would generate from a VB script a template letter for the denial. Or if it's, you know, you're missing this many payments, so we have these templates. So the workflow did all that for us. Then it would generate a flat file for all the ones that were approved and send it over to finance. So basically we would say, here's the ones that you should pay because we've vetted it. We've shown customer service and sales. So we have that document in the system. Here's the file that you need. That's a separate structured file, including the Cognos stream. So Cognos is telling finance, here's what's going to pay. Here's what you need to pay. I'm telling them that I've notified customer service and sales that these are good to go. So everybody's clean. So now finance has the file they need to process the checks. I can then show customer service and sales the date that that check's going to process out and a visual representation of the checks. When you search in the system, you can see, all right, we got your form on this date. Looks like we processed an approval. Checks expected to come, you know, in a week or so. And it's for this amount. This was an amazing streamlined process, and they continued to use it after I was gone until all the rebates had been processed. But it was an amazing tool. I wouldn't say it's the most advanced thing I ever built, but it was the most complex to manage at the time. In hindsight, though, I could have done it 10 times better knowing what I learned later about OnBase and its potential. But doing things like that and the credit workflow and the QA workflow and going through the exercise with Tasimi, every single time, it's like, there's so much potential to this thing. And I want to learn more. I want to get more into it. And so eventually, I got to the point where I had some issues with management. The manager I talked about before, I had issues with him. I had issues with the new director who had replaced the old director. I was just having issues all across the board. I wasn't happy and satisfied. And I felt like it's time for me to move on because, number one, I want to get in more into this OnBase thing, and I think we've hit a peak because they're still laying people off, and I didn't see a future for the company, frankly. They're still around, but nowhere, not the same form. And I probably could have stayed and just taken the check, but I felt like it was not going to be the right fit for me long term. Yes, I left millions of dollars on the table, but for me, it was more about how can I build more of this OnBase solutioning and help solve business problems and add value to it at the same. So I went to a different company that was dealing more with OnBase, where I got to get more exposed with different types of customers, different types of problems. I learned way more tools than I ever thought possible, way more languages than I thought possible, got all my certifications that I now hold, and I was able to kind of branch out and go a little bit further and increase my income along the way. So I realized this OnBase, it was like, this was the key, starting with the director, opening the door to this tool that I didn't even know existed prior to this and didn't have the competency leading in, but I was able to jump in feet first and just kind of learn it, go from there and say, hey, this is pretty cool. I can help solve business problems. I can help make things more efficient and start questioning why we do things as inefficiently as we do, using the software to kind of back it up. The challenge is that as I got to more companies that were using the software, I realized that many of them were nowhere near as flexible or receptive to the idea of streamlining. There was this mentality that we have to keep people, right? That we have to stay inefficient because this is the way we always do things. And that's kind of a mantra that's persisted in every company I've been at, every single one. And so when I try to then do the same thing in some of these other companies, I have limited success. Some of them are very receptive to it, but the vast majority are not. It's not about the tool, because on base, we can prove that it's able to drive value and it's able to make things more efficient and it's able to streamline things. It's about the company and just being resistant to anything that changes what they assume to be true because they didn't know. And you have to prove it to them. And even when you prove it, sometimes they're still resistant to it. So OnBase is part to blame, I would argue, part to blame for some of my frustration with many of the companies, because being exposed with it and trying to use it to introduce the same kind of efficiencies I know I can do and getting that pushback, it's always been a mystery to me. I've never understood why there's that general resistance. And some would say, well, you didn't make the case. No, we can make the case. OnBase sells itself if you know it well enough. It sells itself. But when you don't want to do things like, you know, let's scan the document and we don't need color because there's no color on the document, but it looks nicer, that kind of thing, that's fine. But then storage gets eaten up, right? And then IT resists because storage is getting eaten up. Storage isn't cheap over time. That kind of thing, something as simple as that, all the way up to why are we handling paper files? The I-9 process is a great example of this. You know, why are we handling paper files from start to finish when we can digitize 80% of the process, not wanting to do it for whatever reason? And then there's been different solutions that I've come across where I've been able to magically solve the problem in OnBase, and I've proven that the tool, it can do it and you should trust it. But then there's different groups that come in, different leadership, different whatever come in, and they don't want to do it because they're used to the old school. So that's a lot of it, is people come in that just want to keep things status quo and they don't want to adapt and change in advance. So I never know, being honest, why, but I can just say OnBase as a tool, it's a gift and a curse. It opened doors for where I went. It allowed me to solve a lot of problems. It allowed me to interact with a lot of companies. I got to interact with the BBB. I mean, geez. And meet a lot of different people and go to a lot of conferences. I presented at conferences. And I've been able to create strong solutions from it. And I've been able to quantify that the tool can drive savings. And at some point on a future episode, I'm going to cover that slide deck. I'm going to revisit it. Because it got great feedback from that session. And I think it might have blacklisted me in the eyes of Highland, but I think it's important to understand why I did what I did, why I was so invested in the contracting and OnBase and the solutioning side and the value side, why I thought that this was the right answer. I think it's important to just revisit that slide deck because it is the best representation I can think of how you can drive that value for different people. And it all started, again, from a director who gave me a chance with a position I wasn't qualified for and had no skill in and certainly didn't have the education they asked for. But it's like, you're willing to give me a chance and I'm willing to give it a shot to learn what I don't know. And I don't say that it's easy. It's not easy learning something that you don't know. But I'm saying it's possible. And sometimes when you're getting screwed over, which I was in that call center position with that director of ops, if I'm getting screwed over, I'm not going to stay there and be underutilized when there's so much potential. I think that drive, that desire to be more and do more is lacking today with people. And it's disheartening. Now, I've trained and I've mentored quite a few people, but I have seen a marked decline in that passion, right? Some people have it. Some people, they just need to be pushed in the right direction and they can take it and run with it. I've trained people that were able to double or even triple their income just because they stuck with it. I knew they had the potential to do it. They stuck with it, and they took it and ran with it and surpassed me at some point. I love seeing that, but it's rare because there are a lot of people that just don't seem to want to do that, and they're just kind of comfortable in their own laurels and sit on their own merits and don't want to push themselves to that next level. And I like to think that it's part of the reason that I question staying in the business of not just on-base, but technology, is I'm not seeing the same passion. So I'm not able to mentor and get people that same success I had, which I like doing. It's of anything. If somebody came and said, well, what is the one thing that you really want to do? It is to mentor people to eventually be better than me. That's what I like doing. But I also want to be recognized for that success. When I have successfully mentored somebody to surpass me, I want you to recognize me that I'm the best at what I do because I was able to make somebody better than me. So I must clearly be better than the average. And I don't get that recognition, or haven't gotten that recognition in recent years. And as a result, it's caused me to pull back a little bit, which is a shame because I still think it's a solid platform to work with. But without that drive from other people and without that recognition from companies, and to be fair, Highland has made some changes I don't disagree with in their strategy that makes it harder for that adoption because everybody's starting at the monolithic level, which makes it harder for them to grasp the intricacies. So there's either a lot of custom code, there's a lot of customized solutions, or a lot of garbage, and they're calling somebody like me to help them clean it up, but I can't start from scratch and build it right from the get-go to where it doesn't break like that. Or it's a company where I was able to build it from scratch and get to a point, but somebody comes in from HP or whatever garbage, you know, manufacturing company and wants to change and disrupt things and do things wrong. And then I have to leave because that person and I are not on the same page. So again, there's a lot of different symptoms to it. There's a lot of different factors playing into it. I'm always appreciative of the director for giving me that opportunity and giving me the shot. And I do think that some of it is just a matter of technology coming into play because there are a lot of disruptors in the industry for sure, and cost sensitivity with the pandemic in particular, but also just in general, there's this idea. There has been an idea and a rush towards more customized things that I don't want the user to see any interface that's not ours. And that means you have to do custom code. And then there's a lack of, you know, people as they come out of college, they're taught a certain way and that's all they know. So there's a number of factors. I'm not blaming a tool. I'm not blaming an individual. I'm blaming the general societal migration away from the simplicity of just adding value, of just realizing that you got tools that are there and you got people that are there that are trying to add value to you and allowing them to do that. And as long as they can show and prove, why does it matter whether or not you understand it? You should take the time to try to understand it. That's what's lacking. That's what's missing, I think. So hopefully that's been informational as the initial step of my story. Because as I said, this story spans multiple episodes. This was only the first to just introduce the fact that I've had a lot of exposure to nonsense over time and awesome technologies over time and awesome people over time and garbage people over time. And I can point to each and every one of them in some different way as having some different impact, whether positive or negative. But this OnBase software is right at the center of it, dead center of it. And I was able to avoid most of the smoke using OnBase and solving business problems where I was allowed to. The next episode of this one, I'm going to talk about more of the solution. Because when I left this loan company and I went to the next company, that's where I got to do more solutions. So it's more quantity over quality. It didn't mean the solutions were terrible. It meant that now I'm having to deal with way different personalities in the room. Now I'm having to deal with a sales manager who doesn't know what the heck he's doing. And it was a whole different shift. It was not anywhere close to the experience I have with the director, where now I'm stressing myself out. Whereas afterwards, after I left that company, I no longer would allow myself to get stressed. But at the time, I was stressing myself out because I'm dealing with something I should have never gone into. I don't regret the experience, but I regret allowing myself to be subjected to what I'm subjected to. And I want to tell that story because I think it's important that you understand from my, at least from my perspective, it's important that you understand there is more to, you don't have to stay in any company that doesn't make sense. And if it doesn't make sense, you should feel comfortable leaving. And when you leave, you may go to another company that sounds good on the surface and looks good on the surface, and it's all good initially, but the next story is going to tell you things change even there, and that's why you always have to be ready to pack up and leave when it doesn't make sense for you. And I don't like saying that because it sounds evil, but the truth is I'm never going to be a supporter of being in any position, regardless of how lucrative it is, regardless of how fun and fulfilling the work is. If you're not feeling it, you should be okay leaving and take that knowledge and take what you learn and take those experiences and use them to empower yourself and add value to other companies. There are other companies that may appreciate the skill sets that you have now gleaned at company A. And that's how I had to look at it, because I had to get away from the mentality that I'm beholden to any one company simply because of this skill set that I'm basically the only person who has it in the company. That's not my fault. That's their fault. And if they're not willing to fix the issues that I'm seeing, that I'm calling out, I think it's time for me to leave. And I've been comfortable doing that. And the next story, I think, is going to emphasize that a little bit further.